The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Since last month, the beginning of March, leading privacy position in the Obama administration as the chief privacy officer and the joint officer secondarily of the Department of Homeland Security, which has a lead position on privacy by virtue of a provision that Congress put into the Homeland Security Act. And Mary Ellen Callahan is someone who has demonstrated her interest in privacy by working in that area very actively as a partner at the law firm of Hogan & Harson for more than 10 years. And as a matter of fact, I can think of no better demonstration of someone's commitment to an area of law and policy than to leave a partnership in a big law firm for what has got to be at least a slightly slight reduction of pay. And I'm understating it. Those of us who have been in government service have a pretty good idea of that. Nothing else, nothing more than that would demonstrate that commitment. Mary Ellen is going to be now finishing her time of getting acquainted with the privacy office. She gets about 6 weeks or so, which probably means it's up tomorrow.
Now. Right now, right?
I think it's up right now. And I think will be, without any question, a leader, if not the primary leader, in the privacy area throughout the federal government for the next, what is it that is said now most commonly, for the next 7.8 years? Is that how it's phrased most commonly, would you say?
I serve at the Secretary's discretion.
At the Secretary's discretion, yes. So please join me in welcoming Mary Ellen Callahan to talk about the importance of privacy in the years to come.
Thank you all very much, and thank you, Dan, for those kind words. And even though I had a great time at Hogan & Harson, this was indeed an opportunity that I could not refuse. And I am really honored. I would like to correct him slightly by saying I'm not secondarily the Chief FOIA Officer. I am the Chief Privacy Officer and the Chief FOIA Officer. Together, they are an important combination, and it is not in any way secondary of you or slight of FOIA, and I think actually the two must work in tandem. And in fact, I have members of my staff on both sides who are here today, so they know that I have that philosophy in my approach. I want to talk a little bit about exactly that intersection of open government and privacy for a little bit. As you all know, on January 21st, in his first full day in office, the President issued a memorandum stating the Freedom of Information Act should be administered with a clear presumption that in the face of doubt, openness prevails. He stated that all agencies should adopt a presumption in favor of disclosure in order to renew their commitment to the principles embodied in FOIA and to usher in a new era in government. As Chief FOIA Officer at the Department of Homeland Security, I'm heartened by the President's approach to transparency in government. We are standing at a remarkable intersection of open government and privacy. Again, the balance of privacy and of freedom of information is crucial to open government, and I don't believe that openness in government and privacy protection are inherently antithetical. So what does this new era of openness mean for FOIA requesters and FOIA professionals when considered in light of the 1989 Reporters Committee decision? First, let me review the Reporter Committee decision. I know we spent a lot of time talking about it here today, but I kind of wanted to think about it in light of my dual role at DHS. As of course we all know, the Reporters Committee, as well as a CBS correspondent, attempted to obtain the rap sheet of Charles Medico. We understand it's pronounced. No?
Medico.
Medico. See, I keep messing it up. Sorry. Look to Rory for guidance. I guess that Mr. Medico is appropriately obscured at this point. And you know, the Reporters Committee was looking for material on public record. While the Supreme Court ultimately held that disclosing the contents of an FBI rap sheet to a third party could reasonably be expected to constitute an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy within the meaning of 7C, I think it's the guiding framework articulated in the case that was most dramatic for FOIA. The Supreme Court made clear in the Reporters Committee decision that substantial privacy interests can exist in personal information, even though that information has been made available to the general public at some time and place. This is an important tenet to remember when analyzing the FOIA request itself, even in an era where personal information may be disclosed through a variety of media. And I think we must bear that in mind. When the disclosure is not performed by the subject itself, the practical obscurity standard must continue to be strictly applied. Another element that is crucial when applying the Reporters Committee framework is identity. The court found that the identity of the FOIA requester is irrelevant to determining whether to release the information, unless, of course, the person requesting the information about him or herself, since the privacy interest is protected in the requester's own information. Consistent with the President's presumption of disclosure, a person's individual interest in reviewing their own file is equally as important to recognize as an individual's privacy interest in protecting that information from others' requests. Allowing individuals to access and modify as appropriate their own information while protecting it from disclosure using the Reporters Committee framework is an important tenet when applying FOIA law and one that must continue based on the President's own initiative. Of course, as Dan has indicated and I have as well, given that I'm both Chief Privacy Officer and Chief FOIA Officer, I feel that in my capacity, my office is an outstanding example of the Reporters Committee framework in action. Consistent with the committee's approach to balancing privacy and freedom of information with regards to the requester, the scope of public interest test is equally important and consistent with the January 21st memorandum. The core purpose of FOIA is to, quote, shed light on an agency's performance of its statutory duties. Information that does not reveal government activities or operations, of course, falls outside the scope of public interest that FOIA was enacted to serve. Such information would include personal information about an individual other than the requester. However, information that does directly reveal government operations are to be presumed to be disclosed and disclosable. The Reporters Committee decision is an important element of the U.S. approach to access to information, and that's why we're here today to discuss it at length. But I wanted to also highlight something else. It's an important cornerstone for these concepts worldwide. I know this information firsthand. As I mentioned to Dan earlier today, immediately following the fall of the Berlin Wall and at the commencement of the democratization of Eastern Europe, I was fortunate enough to work for the Library of Congress. I worked at the Congressional Research Service on a congressional task force on the development of parliamentary institutions in Central and Eastern Europe. Although I didn't recognize it then, that was the beginning of what was probably a life-changing experience for me. And quite frankly, as a result, I may be destined to be the Chief Privacy Officer, Chief FOIA Officer at the Department of Homeland Security as a result of my experiences with these fledgling democracies. It was during my time at the Library of Congress that I grew to understand the value of access to information and democratic processes. To put it in context, when the first congressional delegation traveled to the then Czechoslovakia and met in the Federal Assembly, the research library of Czechoslovakia, which of course was the most western of all of the Eastern European countries and certainly Prague is a fabulous destination to visit, at that time the research library associated with the parliament's most recent resource was a 1961 world book. They were performing research with information that was obsolete 20 years before. What Congress ended up realizing was these parliaments needed information and needed to be able to inform their constituents in order to govern effectively. With that said, of course, given the misuse of government information about individuals during the previous regime, these democracies supported the concept of substantial privacy interests existing in personal information. The parliaments at the time, and actually probably even to this day, were attempting to build democratic institutions where access to information was tantamount. Given their past experience, these countries felt strongly that information about government actions should be made both publicly and within the parliament without consideration for party affiliation. While the development of an independent research institution would solidify both the working of the legislative process, but also the education of the citizenry. Following working with these Central and East European parliaments for 4 years, I decided to go to law school. Those of you in the room who are in law school, I don't regret it that much. No, it's a joke. When I went to law school, though, I didn't lose my interest in the development of Central and Eastern European democracies. In fact, after my first year in law school, I traveled to Lithuania. I worked in Lithuania with the American Bar Association Central and East European Law Initiative. And quite frankly, it was a phenomenal experience to work so closely with the parliaments. You'll be interested in the story. The internet at the time was still fairly new and not widely available, but I was fortunate enough to have my first wide-scale experience using the internet for research while working with CLE. In fact, I used services that were made available in the parliament as part of the tangible support provided by the Congressional Task Force for whom I previously worked. Through Netscape Navigator, you guys all remember that? the parliament and I were able to access information and be exposed to information related to governance and comparative legal structures that the access of which would have been punishable by prison a few scant years previously. It's funny to think about how novel and exciting the idea of internet access to information was at the time, particularly as Dan mentioned, given my work at Hogan & Hartson, particularly on online privacy issues. But it was crucial that the parliament be able to access this type of information in a wide range from sources that were previously unavailable to anyone in their countries. And that was just an amazing opportunity. To me, however, the most important part of my work at CLE was when I was asked by the parliament to conduct a comparative look of the United States Freedom of Information Act and similar acts in European countries in order to provide guidance to Lithuania as they attempted to draft their own Freedom of Information Act. They had been independent for less than 4 years at the time, and membership in the European Union was a dream so remote that people would dare not utter such a fantasy. And yet access to information and open government was as important to this new democracy as it is to our government in 2009. The concepts of accountable government coupled with the respect for personal privacy are universal. And the reporter committee decision is an important balance in that discussion. We all look forward to fulfilling President Obama's directive to take affirmative steps to make information readily available to the public through routine disclosure. While this process initially may need more work for my office and for other FOIA offices throughout the government, as we are working on enhancing our systems, of routine disclosure to the government, the result will be better for citizens and the government alike. The steps needed to move forward to a more open government must be made, but they must be made with deliberation and finesse, because a reporter committee holding is, in fact, consistent with this new era of open government. Nuanced decision-making serves us all, whether you be on the Baltic or inside the Beltway. President Obama and Attorney General Holder have directed us to respond to requests for information in that spirit of cooperation. While helping with Lithuania's development of its own Freedom of Information Act, through my 4 years with the Library of Congress, working with nascent democracies, and in my new role here at the Department of Homeland Security, it has become clear that access to information, particularly access to information about what the government is doing, serves as a necessary oversight measure on the functions of government. Even though the process in Lithuania now differs from the process in the United States, it's telling that there was recognition early on that access to information and transparency in government are the only way a true democratic government can survive. The suppression of knowledge and information leads to a disaffected, disinterested, and sometimes angry citizenry, whether the country be a newly emerging democracy or one that is a bedrock for democratic ideals. Our rededication to openness and transparency in government can only serve to make government more accountable to the public. The public is our conscience, and these measures make it easier for them to take ownership of what I feel to be their responsibility to this country. We have been directed to disclose information without regard to whether disclosure of that information may cause embarrassment to government officials, and without regard to whether errors or failures may be revealed. We have been directed to make partial disclosures of information when full disclosure of information is not possible. We have been directed to be facilitators, to be true agents of the people we serve. In a way, I feel power in this responsibility. We all own a part of that responsibility to make sure that this country meets these goals. I am someone that is responsible for making sure these requests for information are not hindered, and I'm sure that many FOIA professionals and privacy professionals in the room today may feel this power and their responsibilities as well. Notice I say power and not weight in this capacity. As we modify our calculations from how can I withhold this information to how can I release this information, I'm sure FOIA officers throughout the government will challenge themselves to disclose as much information as possible while simultaneously protecting personal information. Again, openness of government and protecting privacy rights is a delicate balance to strike. The Privacy Act is designed to prevent unreasonable invasions into personal privacy, and we cannot lose focus on privacy rights and the newly emphasized spirit of disclosure. Both are equally important and can definitely coexist. This new era of openness should not be confused with a disregard for privacy. All the President's directives are to be implemented in accordance with law, and there are so many things to consider when it comes to privacy and the disclosure of information, whether the issues be personal privacy issues, national security issues, law enforcement, or a myriad of other issues that may arise when a FOIA request is made. With that said, what does this new era of openness mean in light of the Reporters Committee decision? Well, there's no black and white answer, just various shades of gray. Finding a middle ground should be the new goal in this era of openness. It should mean that while we're stepping away from categorical presumption of non-disclosure in favor of disclosure, we must now take time to assess what should be disclosed under the rule of law. We should together renew our commitment to the principles embodied in FOIA while heeding the Reporters Committee standard. I believe that we can and must engage in openness and transparency of government while protecting personal privacy. Thank you. I believe Dan has maybe a subject of questions, if there are any.
Well, I just phrase it another way. I guess you'd say that Mary Ellen has graciously agreed to answer your questions. And not only that, but she's gone so far as to say, in a rather pointed way, that although she's held her position only since the 9th of March and has spoken to a number of groups, she's already found some disappointment in that the questions haven't been quite as challenging.
That's exactly what I said, as you
can imagine. I'm paraphrasing this, and I assured her that she was in an academic institution, one that does pride itself on the Socratic method from time to time, and that pointed questions are stock and trade, and that she could count on not only a volume of questions, but they're being rather repeated as well. And I'll start everyone off if I can. Mary Ellen spoke about the presumption changing in this new spirit of openness, no longer a categorical presumption of withholding, I think is how you phrased it. Mm-hmm. So my question now, in the spirit of that big element of the Reporters Committee decision, do you foresee in government in general, or maybe just DHS in particular, which is, after all, a law enforcement agency, to be sure, like what was involved with the Justice Department, do you see perhaps there being less categorical holding, less implementation of that element of the Reporters Committee decision in the future? Now, that's not a pointed question. Go ahead.
Not at all. I mean, as Dan pointed out, there are law enforcement elements that must be considered. There are, in the situation of DHS, national security issues, that also may be considered. But I think, Dan, the question about whether there's a presumption of withholding information and designation of categorical withholding, I think that that will change. And I think that that will, it may be incremental change, I think is a better way of seeing it. At the same time, protecting the information from disclosure that needs to be protected for the reasons why it needs to be protected, whether it be privacy, law enforcement, or national security.
Hi, I have a question. My name is Nicole Booker. I'm actually a private investigator in a number of different jurisdictions. And my question relates to the federal side of stuff as opposed to the state side of FOIA. And I good best of luck to you in your new position. But as the director of FOIA for DHS, I mean, where do you see the line being drawn between what states have the right to kind of dictate as open government and what they should provide to their citizens as opposed to what federal should do? Do you see any difference there, or do you think that the states will follow through with what the government is doing?
If I can just briefly repeat in case the webcast didn't pick it up, the question is whether or not there should be some sort of relationship or agreement between federal FOIA laws and the state laws that, of course, have various and sundry standards on what information can be provided. I think I'll have to actually punt on this one and say that's a little far beyond my mandate. I certainly have used state FOIA laws and FOIA laws and sunshine laws, whatever we want to call it, in each of the states to seek information. But at the same time, I would argue that in my role at DHS, it's not one to make policy in terms of those intergovernmental relations.
What about fusion centers where the states are collecting the information and governments using it, or other areas where local law enforcement collects information?
To the extent that there's a DHS element, of course, Ari. Yeah, no, absolutely. To the extent that there's a DHS element, there would be FOIA. But I understood her question to be kind of state governmental laws and whether or not they too should have a presumption of openness. I would hope, as a best practice, and as a supporter of open government, that they would agree with that approach, but it's certainly not my role to tell them so when I'm outside of the capacity of DHS. We do have similar approaches in terms of wanting to balance, as I mentioned earlier, the information about government activities and operations versus protecting the privacy of employees to the extent that that's appropriate. I don't believe we have as blanket an exception as you guys do, but I know that we do provide some, we do apply Exemption 6 in some ways. At the same time, I think each department has to look at their own circumstances, and DOD, having a person's name maybe disclosed, maybe higher sensitivity. In addition, there may be privacy elements within the information, for example, phone numbers and so on, that may make sense to apply 6 to. With that said, I think, as I said, each department has to look at how they can meet the openness standard in their own way. And I think you may want to reassess whether or not completely withholding all the names meets that goal and meets that purpose. I think there's some tension there.
Well, I guess I had to come because I've been told that no, we will not reconsider because we have case law that supports it. So I guess my question then is, do you think it could successfully be challenged?
In my new capacity, I'm not acting as a lawyer, but I think that there's certainly, I think there are certainly pretty strong arguments, and I bet there are several in the room who would take that case.
Mike, have you restarted the processing of any FOI requests to apply the new guidelines, or are you reevaluating the government's position in any pending FOI court cases?
We are We are applying the president's memorandum going forward. We have not gone back on a wholesale level to look at previous FOIA requests.
Yes.
Yeah, my name is Bruce Holm, and I represent the private investigative and contract security industry legislatively. And my son, by the way, James, was a Sealy fellow assigned to Lithuania.
Oh, is that right?
From about maybe 96.
Oh, that's right. You must have just overlapped. Or must have just listened to
him. About that time. You got a lot out of it. This is just a comment. I would like, we talk about, you know, the various reasons. I'd like to add one more phrase that could be used now and then. And that's in the interest of justice to get this information. And I just wish there were more instances where there would be a means of when one was seeking information. Not just balancing what's the effect on the government end versus the privacy aspect, but in the interest of justice, and that even taking it trumping sometimes both of the other reasons for access.
Well, I would actually think that the phrase in the interest of justice would fall both within the openness concept and the privacy concept. I think that that's embedded within it. But I take your point that I think that there are factors that need to be considered when participating in open government across the board.
My name is Pat Clausen. I'm a private investigator and an investigative reporter. The question I've got is, with the information that's coming out of your agency, how can your agency set up a mechanism to make it easy for individuals to track what is actually being released by your agency? I mean, I've run into repeatedly over 20-odd years of using FOIA in this town, where we've had cases where agencies have been reinventing the wheel in terms of processing requests. Is there anything underway at your office or anything that could be put underway to take information that's released once it's released to a requester pursuant to FOIA, not Privacy Act, pursuant to FOIA, that information could be just automatically posted on to the department's website, the electronic reading room?
We certainly are looking at all opportunities to improve the disclosure of information, the electronic reading room, what types of information are up there, and also systematizing it along the DHS components. If you've been doing FOIA requests for 20 years, you know we're only here six.
Right.
And we definitely have growing pains, and we have some components who are doing FOIA processing very efficiently, very effectively, and using electronic means efficiently and effectively. Others are not doing that as well, and we're really trying to have a standardization of the FOIA processing and in terms of what goes in the reading room. So yes, that's definitely part of the process.
It seemed to me that in connection with the president's mandate to start trying to streamline government functions, that it just makes sense from a cost standpoint for the department, if nothing else, and for an efficiency standpoint, to immediately just begin posting material to the web as it's being released.
I don't disagree with you. Mm-hmm. And as I said, that's definitely, I mean, there are two different questions. I think there are two embedded questions that you've asked. One is what information is being released
right.
by the agency, and as that information is being released in a public capacity, that is going on the web. That's going on the DHS.gov site. I can't speak to other agencies, but that's certainly something we do. And then the second question is what do we do about FOIA? What do we do about disclosures and so on? And that one's going to be harder to get our arms around. As I said, we've got components at various stages, but I completely agree with you on the principle.
Excuse me. I'm Wendell Cochran. I teach journalism here. So you've got one mission, which is to train the people that are working for you in your office and across the agency, but you also have to interface with the agency, the heads, the people in ICE and other places. What do you have a seat at that table, and are you being heard, and do you say every day that the president says this, or what are you getting back from the people who really are in charge of whether information gets released?
Right, and just to repeat the question again, in case the webcast couldn't get it, is essentially he asked, you know, as chief FOIA officer at the department, I'm training both my staff in terms of how to meet the president's mandate, but what am I doing about the component FOIA responses? And as
so far, I'm more interested in the people who run the program.
Well, fair, right. And I was just trying to recount the statement. And to be fair, my office does implement a lot of FOIA requests, and we do have a staff that works on that for requests that go either across different components or at the headquarters level at DHS. Within the components themselves, which you mentioned, ICE, which is Immigration Customs Enforcement, Customs and Border Patrol, all of those things, we've got a variety of elements that we filled 100,000 FOIA requests last year throughout the department. So to answer your question in terms of how are we getting that mission out, that statement out, I've met with each of the component heads and I've talked to them about both roles in my office, the privacy element and the FOIA element, and have stressed the importance of both, quite frankly. And in terms of working on the FOIA issues, I'm also meeting bi-weekly with the FOIA officers in each component and, in fact, implementing a plan on the president's openness to make sure that it's systematized, as we talked about before. So we are working on this, and we're taking it quite seriously. But we are reaching out at the component level because a lot of FOIA requests are going to the components, and they're also going to headquarters. So, question in the corner?
Yep. I'd like to follow up on a response a few questions ago. If I'm a requester, and assuming DHS and its components are now applying the Openness Directive going forward, if I'm a requester with a pending request, should I refile that request? Should I come to my FOIA officer to whom I've been assigned and ask, will you reevaluate this based on the new Openness
Directive? No, the question that Mike asked was about previous requests. Are we reevaluating
right.
previously?
Right, my request is pending.
On pending requests, yeah, we're applying it going forward.
Okay.
Yeah. So no sense and no need to reapply.
Going forward means with respect to agency decisions, not with respect to the date of the request.
Yes. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear. I'm sorry.
And
yes.
Second follow-up with that, same question earlier. If I have a pending court case and it sounds like DHS isn't itself going back, perhaps based on the memorandum from Holder to evaluate whether or not to apply those same standards, how would I encourage DHS, how would I do anything about that as someone with that pending court case to see if these new openness directives might apply?
I don't know if we've had that circumstance yet. I don't know if we've had cases that have had it.
Any pending case to which this openness directive.
Remember, I'm not a lawyer in this capacity. I mean, I'm not handling the litigation. I turned to Bill, who's one of my FOIA people.
On a case-by-case basis, we would, of course, if the opportunity arose to reevaluate.
How would the opportunity arise?
Well,
as the litigator, would I have to come to DHS to encourage that, or is that automatically occurring now?
It's a part of our process. We've been instructed by the executive branch to engage in openness. As I said, I'm not handling the litigation, which is why I hesitated at your question. But I think that certainly the concepts are being discussed at each level. It's a lawsuit, so it's part of the FOIA lawsuit process. I'm not trying to obscure the record here. I'm not trying to do that at all. But what I'm saying is that. We're not handling litigation, but as I said, we certainly discuss these concepts with people who are.
I can tell you, I'll try to speak loud, as the person who implemented this the last time around in 1993, the responsibility does rest upon the Justice Department litigator first and foremost to then discuss it with the client agency,
exactly.
Which would be you. So that's really where the rubber meets the road, either the AUSA or the main justice attorney, or in a few cases, the tax division attorney, on whom that responsibility rests first and foremost.
Right, just to repeat it, as Dan pointed out, the DOJ has the primary litigation responsibilities in this capacity, and they are obviously quite aware of the president's directive.
Yeah.
It's a related question, actually. Alex Wood, attorney of the Postal Service. As part of AG Holder's guidelines, mm-hmm. they reinstituted the foreseeable harm standard, that whenever an agency decides to withhold information, there has to be some type of foreseeable harm of disclosing that information. And I was curious of whether that foreseeable harm standard can be applied within the Exemption 6 context, or is it something that's implicit in this balancing between privacy and public interest? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, Alice, I think it does. And so, again, the question is whether or not the Attorney General has indicated that we should apply a foreseeable harm standard, and whether that should be expressly within Exemption 6 or whether or not it's implicit within the concepts of personal privacy. I think it's a little bit of both. I think from an exemption standpoint, six makes sense, but again, you have to ask the question about whether or not withholding that information would indeed indicate foreseeable harm, as we talked about in the DOD context. I mean, I think that's got to be one of the questions that you ask, and again, that may be subject to challenge.
And it seems as though under the Bush administration there was a lot of rollback in access to information about immigration detainees and proceedings and who's being held. Are there any sort of plans to review those policies and open up more information in the proceedings?
Yes. I mean, that's the president's initiative.
How? Do you have any concrete plans? I mean, particularly with regard to those.
I mean, to a certain extent, I can't give you concrete plans for many reasons, as I hopefully you understand. But at the same time, understand that that is clearly part of the process and clearly something we've conveyed specifically and across the department.
Do you, Mary Ellen, foresee any particular types, put aside categories, but types of information for which privacy protection in the past may no longer, under the president's policy, be applied in the future?
Categories or types of information where...
Or an example of something that might be disclosed going forward that sometime during the past 8 years, let's say, was withheld on the basis of one privacy exemption or the other.
Yes, in fact, my office and I are working on having a comprehensive list on what information should be disclosed as a matter of course. And it is not final yet, but we are working on types of records that would be accessible that previously were not on the agency website but have it accessible as a matter of course.
Will that information be available to the public?
Yes, that's what I said, on the website.
I mean that list? Will we be able to see what has changed?
The information will be up on the website, as a matter of course, yes.
Can we FOIA the list that you're making?
Sure. Absolutely. This isn't FOIA, it's pretty traditional, but you're welcome to.
You can FOIA it, that doesn't mean you're going to get it.
Exactly. Absolutely.
But what they're really asking at, once that list is final,
right.
We'll be using it basically as a management tool, as an instruction to the staff.
Absolutely, exactly.
And everyone knows that instructions to staff are things that you don't even have to FOIA, quote unquote, because they're automatically required to be posted in the reading room under subsection A2.
Yep.
So you can look for that there, as you say, or push them with an A3 request as well.
I'll make it final.
Well, I mean, we're working on lists. We've been talking to a lot of people about what types of records they would want to get available as a matter of practice. And that's what we're doing. So we look forward to your request. Yes.
We're always asking your office for something.
Uh-huh.
Right? What can we do to help you?
Keep asking me hard questions. I mean, I'm serious. Keep asking the hard questions to make sure that we get the right answers.
Okay, here's one. When you have your list, for all we know, you will be the first agency of the 93 agencies subject to the FOIA to have such a list, to be forward-leaning that way with such instructions to staff to have a better process. Will you then share your list with other agencies so they don't have to invent the wheel, even mindful of the fact that your types of records are not the same as those at other agencies? Is that something that you would try to do as a good government step across the board?
I think that makes a lot of sense, and not only will we share the list with our agencies, we'll share it with the public. I mean, that's part of the open government concept.
I have a quick question.
obviously some impacts from the FOIA initiative from the president are being felt now with the new decision going forward. But I've been asked how long until we see some sort of significant impact from the openness initiative. Can you give a timetable, check back in a year, 6 months, or when do you think people who don't necessarily follow the ins and outs of FOIA every day will start seeing an impact?
I mean, I would say that with the disclosure of the torture memos, you've already seen an impact, and that's a pretty significant one. That obviously is not my agency, but that, to me, is a cornerstone example of open government and of disclosure and of transparency. So I think that the impact's already being incurred. Yeah.
Yes, as a leading agency on the new openness, what involvement do you have with OMB and the White House on the development of this policy?
To date, we've been focusing on department opportunities, not on OMB.
And going forward?
I hope so.
Mary Ellen, he might mean with respect to the openness and transparency initiative.
Oh, with the open government initiative. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I have been working on that. So I didn't understand your question. I was thinking of it more on OMB specifically, not the open government initiative that's currently in its 120-day review. We have been working with their office in terms of striking that balance between privacy and access to information. Yes.
So what are your metrics for being able to say, all right, here's what we've been able to do to demonstrate our commitment to this, and as someone made the point this morning, access costs money. Do you, in the budget that's been approved, do you get more people in your function to do what you need to do?
I think there are a couple of questions in there. One, in terms of money, I think we have the resources available to make this part of the process. As I mentioned in my speech, there may be some growing pains as we work through this, and the money may shift to other circumstances, whether it may be, you know, quote-unquote bandwidth issues or staffing issues or proselytizing issues in terms of with the components, but we are attempting to be as prepared as we can be on this rollout.
And metrics for knowing that you're making the kind of progress you'd like to make?
I don't understand what you mean by metrics.
Well,
I mean,
you've got backlog, you've got the number of exemptions applied, you've got the number of full disclosure, partial disclosure, full denials. How will
okay,
we know?
Sorry, not, I was hearing the question in a different way. We have obviously all those metrics that are quite public in terms of.
Do you have
of
goals in terms of, I want the backlog to be half?
I want the backlog to be zero. I mean, I think that's pretty simple, but I want the backlog to be zero. We've got to get there. We've got to go incrementally. So in terms of, and there's going to be, as I said, tension as we work on complying with this stuff. As you know, DHS has a backlog, and different components have very significant backlogs, and that is something that I've talked to each of the components, particularly those with the backlogs, and they are attempting to address them. To answer your question on whether or not I personally have benchmarks on where we are to be in 6 months, 1 year, not yet. Yes?
I'm a visiting scholar here. I want to follow Mr. Professor Dan McCaff's question. Do you share your information with state agencies? And may I give a personal example first? That's about the applying for private license. And my husband and I live in Maryland. And when we went to the company of the Maryland website, and we were told that my husband's I-94 form does not match his personal information. I don't understand that. That's why. And we were told we need to go to the Department of Homeland Security. And I went to your website. I can't find the exact agency who are in charge of our affairs. So I asked for somebody else, and I was told to go to the airport. And the problem is finally solved, but I just don't understand in what way can this kind of information go to a state agency like both of these administrations or something like this, because they are dealing with the daily affairs of every understand person. Thank you.
I think the crux of your comment is that the DHS website is not clear, and I agree with you. I do. I mean, and that is one of my observations from the outside and from the inside, that education and public education on how to access information and even what the elements, you know, which component, which would be USCIS, would impact this, is something that we need to improve. And I completely agree with you. With regard to sharing information with the state agencies with regard to the Freedom of Information Act, as I mentioned, they have a separate process pursuant to their state laws. With regard to sharing information with state agencies in order to, for example, in the state of Maryland, make sure that you are a legal resident. That's one of the Maryland requirements according to their state laws. We all know from the discussions that took place in Annapolis this year, to the extent that the state wants that or needs that information in order to provide your husband's driver's license, then DHS provides that information with strict guidelines on what they can do with it, with proof that it can be only used for certain purposes, for example, in this circumstance, to confirm that you and your husband comply with state law. Who can access that information? They have strict requirements on tailoring that information to make sure that the with whom the information can be shared, how the information can be accessed, how long the information can be stored, and for what purposes are all clearly defined when information sharing occurs to state agencies. And that's an important tenet, both on the access to information, but also on the privacy side, that we need to make sure that information sharing is governed that way.
I'm sorry, I still not very clear. When we were told to go to the Department of Homeland Security, I think the Motor Vehicle Administration of Maryland do not have good kind of information on this. So that's why we are told to solve this problem by our own.
I'm not sure in your specific circumstance. So I'm sorry if I didn't answer your question.
I thought we should have this kind of information.
Well, if they're comparing the I-94 information, then they have some information from DHS. And so that's the way I presumed when I answered the question about information sharing and what the requirements are and restricting the use of that information. So they have something. I just don't know what it is.
Mary Ellen, speaking of benchmarks, I think you set a new benchmark for candor and graciousness of our luncheon speakers here. And you have a lot of people in this room who really wish you well.
Thank you.
And going forward, as you say, in implementing the new openness regime and also your privacy responsibilities as well. So, again, everybody.